Hello and welcome to Dialect. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002 and goes out every Thursday morning at 11 a.m. here on BCFM 93.2. I'm Tony Gosling, and this week, lots of tech advice and a warning about digital ID, which is supposed to be wonderful. It's being sorted out for you by the government. Plus, our weekly news update with Jason Yannakopoulos. Dialect is produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, just off Queen's Square. You can call them on 0117 989 7733, and I'll repeat those details at the end of the show. But we start this week with Julie Beale, who's been looking into this digital ID. Hi, Julie. Welcome to Dialect.
Thank you, Tony.
First of all, what is the basics of this? What online activity is this new government digital ID supposed to help with?
It's meant to help with all aspects of our lives, to be honest. It depends which things that we focus on. If we talk about the government aspect, it will be all public services will be digital, or health services will be, that they all need you to prove who you are with this online identity, which I've nicknamed Global Smart ID.
Okay. Is there an official term for it that the government are using?
They're calling it identity assurance, but it's called different things around the world. In Iran, for instance, it's called Smart ID. I mean, this thing is really literally, it's global.
Now, I thought this was just something for Britain, but it's not. It's for right around the world. That's an incredibly ambitious project. How far along down the line is it?
It's very nearly up and running. It's already been trialled. Apparently, that the UK is, because our form is slightly different, we're kind of leading the world. Other countries have just got an EID, that's a European electronic identity, and which has a smart chip in the card. But in the UK and America, they know that we don't want identity cards, so they're trying to make it all purely digital. But there's no getting away from the fact that it does require having some kind of smart technology, otherwise you won't be able to do it.
So is the idea in other parts of the world then that you've got a card you carry in your wallet or something, and then when you're next to the computer you sort of plug that into the computer to prove that's who you are?
Yeah, they store biometrics on the chip, and then they have various other ways of like proving who you are, because it's all remote. It's how to prove yourself online without any person being involved. It's all done with technology. In the countries that have got an electronic ID, they can access government services online. So all governments are becoming e-gov, electronic government. So there's a huge wall going up between citizens and the government.
Now, it means also, that, of course, that if you're not on the internet, you won't be able to get any of these things, or at least it will be much more difficult for you. When you say without anybody involved, that means just the person who's at the end of the terminal who's trying to access the services, and the rest of it will be automatic?
Yeah, all of it is. All of it's done through identity providers and attribute providers.
Okay, now, what about biometrics? You mentioned that there. This is a new term, isn't it? Really come in the last, 10 years or maybe 20 years or so. These biometrics, what are they?
They are a way of sampling the human body for its unique characteristics, like fingerprints, the pattern of your iris, even the veins in the palm of your hand can be used as biometrics. And a copy can be taken and stored on a chip that's what's already happened with our passports, isn't it? We've got biometric passports. So a copy is stored inside there and can be compared to a database to check and see if that really is, if it really is you, because it's unique. But it's very invasive, I feel.
Well, it is. I mean, it's a sort of stuff from science fiction films, and obviously the possibility for this is, you know, is that it may be abused. But going back to the online, what online activities you use to do this? I mean, the most important online activities, obviously, to do with keeping you alive, keeping you with food, giving you access possibly to your bank account, this kind of thing, and benefits. So, are you saying that these EIDs or digital smart IDs are going to be mandatory for everybody that wants to claim a benefit, and without it, you will literally starve?
Well, that's what I'd like to know. I think we need some answers from the government. I can tell you what David Rennie said.
Who's David Rennie?
He was from the Cabinet Office, and he's leading this agenda for making the UK digital by default. He says that it all comes from a report by Martha Lane Fox. David Rennie was at a meeting he phoned up the IDESG group in America and updated them on how the UK is doing. And I'm going to actually quote what he said. He said, GDS, that's Government Digital Services, I think, was created to pursue this agenda. All government services have to be built from the ground up to be digital first. Then we've got to think about the people who are unable to use digital channels. We think of them as a secondary consideration. So we get it right 80% of the time in the first instance. So in other words, what he's saying is that they are expecting 80% of the UK to be able. He's not talking about willing. He's talking about that he thinks that 80% of the UK population will be able to use this service. There isn't a choice being given. They're framing it as a choice in the sense of you get to choose from 5 identity providers. In other words, you have to hand over control of your identity to people like Google and Microsoft and Facebook.
Hang on a minute, because that's privatising it before it's even started. I would have thought at the very minimum, any kind of digital ID, personal ID system, would have to be run by the government, not by some private business. How on earth has that happened?
Well, that's what they're making a big song and dance about. They're saying, isn't it wonderful? It's not a government thing. That's what I mean about that they're saying. I mean, even David Rennie said in that presentation that I've just quoted from that it's not really, you know, it's hard for it to be accepted in the UK and the US. So they say that it being private is a good thing because the government aren't involved, but the government are involved hugely because they are identity providers themselves. They issue the passports and driving licenses and things, and you know, those are classed as credentials or attributes. The contract from the post office, I'm really wondering about why this wasn't discussed when the post office was up for tender, and there's been a lot of controversy about that. So why didn't they talk about the fact that they intend to provide identity assurance services?
Well, the post office had already been privatised. It was Royal Mail that was privatised last year.
All right.
But anyway, I mean, the question I want to put to you, Julie, is has the public been asked about this? Has it been debated in Parliament? And has it been debated in the national press? Because it's obviously a massive change for people to be handing their own personal identities over to private companies and not being able to, for example, get benefits, get access to bank accounts, get access to all the things that they're used to and need to live through the online services, various online services, everything you can think of, basically, through a private business. So has there been any debate about it? I mean, we live in a democracy. Surely a debate is absolutely necessary and a discussion before a decision can be reached about something as important as this.
I thought that's what democracy meant, but I've never seen much sign of democracy. All we get to do is vote. So, no, I don't understand why journalists aren't covering this, because there's a huge amount of information. I'm just absolutely drowning in it. And the idea of queuing up in the post office to, have my biometrics checked, and they're the ones that are going to be dealing with if your identity is revoked as well.
Hang on. Your identity is revoked?
Yeah,
what does that mean?
Once upon a time, my bank account, I went to put my card in, and it swallowed my card, and in the end, I couldn't get any money, and I did telephone banking and was told, every time I told them my date of birth, I was told that was wrong and I couldn't get access to my account. And I had to go in and take in, you know, my passport and stuff to my local branch. And they'd made an error and given out money from my account. Now, that was just one card. If your identity gets revoked, so one thing, if one thing goes wrong, that could be enough for the identity provider to say, sorry, you know, it's rejected, basically. And that means that you lose access to everything. So better get down to the post office and beg. And I don't know how you can discuss things like that at the counter with somebody.
Now, this is incredible. So you're saying that the database that is used by your people who are providing you with banking services, which has got your date of birth, the various details about you, and they actually came back and said to you, I'm sorry, you've got the wrong date of birth because someone had altered it. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, someone, you know, it was somebody in the bank. Like, someone had come in, they'd lost their card and reported it and then said that they still wanted to get money out, and they took it from my account and then stopped my card. And when I asked about it, she said that there was just one number wrong. And I thought about it afterwards, and I thought, well, one number wrong. If I do telephone banking, I have to go through a whole series of questions. So anyway, it just makes you think, doesn't it, about how easy it is for things to go wrong. I'm sure there's plenty of people out there who've had similar problems.
You know what, Julie, it makes me think of all those memory sticks and CDs that have been left on trains by these government officials and private people, and just quite how secure our data is. I don't think it's very secure at all. Anyway, what's the latest on the smart ID, and how far has it got so far?
It's going very slowly, to be honest. I mean, in terms of, it was meant to be rolled out with universal credit in the autumn last year, and it's still not up and running for that. They're going to be introducing, so they've got, so you can have access to your driving license, and basically so you can check your tax status online as well. The PAYE, the tax code, look at your record.
Now, I'm afraid HMRC, Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs, who do all this tax work, have got a pretty appalling record. They keep getting people, basically trying to take people to court for tax that they don't owe. It doesn't sound to me as if they can really be trusted with this. Have you thought very much about other potentials for abuse? Because we've talked about that quite a lot here, but it seems there's an enormous potential for abuse, particularly when this is being handled by private businesses who could be quite easily bribed by somebody to mess with someone's life.
Absolutely. But it's not just... There's another, like, they've got various, basically, it's a militarization of the internet, because all of these standards are satisfactory to the military. They have helped to implement the encryption that's going to be used, and it's them and the top corporations that have got a vested interest in controlling exactly who has access. It's basically about accessing the internet. They call it a circle of trust. What they're saying is that they don't trust you. You have to prove yourself continually before you're allowed privileges, access to buildings even, or benefits.
Yeah, it certainly does sound like all of the people that thought that they'd won out with stopping the national identity card, which of course was largely because people felt that it was too fascist. The idea that, you know, the Nazis would always ask people everywhere they went, where do you have your papers? Let's see your papers. And they decided in Britain that we didn't want to go down that Nazi route. There's a sort of whiff of fascism about this as well. For many people, the idea that the government and private companies can control everything you do through this private ID system. And anyway, which private companies are going to be rolling out this smart ID, Julie?
Google, there's quite a lot of identity providers. So, you know, there are certain websites that you can go to now where it says sign in with Facebook, sign in with Google, Twitter, LinkedIn. They're all using what's called OpenID. And if you do that, then the website owner gets access to your personal information. They say that it's user controlled, but I would much rather have, if I had to have a digital copy of my own birth certificate, passport, etc., I'd rather carry that myself than have an identity provider do it for me.
That's amazing. I mean, it's privatisation of our very most basic personal information. Anyway, finally, Julie, where can people go online to find out more about this, or else even out in the real world, maybe?
Well, I've had all my information from webinars and things like biometric updates, and it's all very much in the industry, the security industry. But I just want to make people realise that all this stuff about the NSA.
You mean Edward Snowden revelations?
Yeah, and about the NSA and GCHQ having access to our information. This is already happening. I suggest people check out Experian, which is an identity provider, and they have a data set called Mosaic, which gives fine-grained detail on individual households. Not postcodes, but individual, every household within the UK. It's called Mosaic. And they give psychographic, behavioural, transactional and demographic data.
Scary stuff. It's the sort of stuff that if Hitler had this back in the 1930s, he would have been salivating, wouldn't he?
Yeah, absolutely.
Anyway, Julie, just tell us a little bit about yourself and what got you interested in the whole smart ID agenda.
Basically, I came across the NSTIC document, which is really where this has come from, the National Strategy for Trusted Identities in Cyberspace, which is in America. And I felt a responsibility to tell others, especially when I kept trying to find information that was reported by journalists, and couldn't understand why such a huge topic hadn't been reported on. And basically, I've wanted to know what my world is going to be like in the future. I don't want to have this. And everything, putting all eggs in one basket, in other words, on that little microchip, means that if you lose your phone, because it will be a phone if it's for all payments, then the way I see it, we are very, very close to being implanted with that chip. You'd still have the phone, but the chip would then, would be like NFC, kind of linking with your phone. But then you wouldn't lose it, would you? All that information.
So did you have any kind of... did you work in the electronics industry or in banking or something before you started looking into this?
No, it's a huge struggle, and I think people should be helping. I think people in the security industry who've been working on this technology, when they realise it's part of a huge picture, like, as I said, it's a militarisation of the internet. They're creating, the identity providers are going to be like gatekeepers, and they're eating our data, eating it. The World Economic Forum says data is the new asset class, and they are selling this information about us. And they will continue to do so. This is a scheme. Instead of us carrying our information and them not making money out of it, they're going to be doing it like this. And in the future, I'm going to be writing about the trusted platform module, because trusted computing, the standards have been they've been heavily influenced and worked on throughout the years by the National Security Agency. And they've put out a white paper saying that the opt-in should no longer be optional. It's a hardware security, and it will lead to, I think, from what I can tell, data rights management, copyright control, basically, and could even end open source software. So I think people really need to be aware that the keys are being injected by the manufacturers. They keep a copy of, I think it's the private key. It satisfies the NSA. they're happy. Internet lockdown.
And whereabouts can people go to read some of your articles online?
Okay, getmindsmart.com. It's a rubbish website, but all of them have been published at activistpost.com. So I would say big up to them. Thank you very much, Activist Post.
And thank you very much, Julie Beale.
And to you, Tony, for having me on. Right, this is how I normally sound. So thanks very much, Tony. At least I've done it now.
Okay.
Thank you.
All the best, love.
Thank you.
Cheerio.
Bye.
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 You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
And from another tack, looking at online stuff, we are joined now by Julianne Burrows from Get It Together Bristol. Hi, Julie. Welcome to Dialect.
Thanks, Tony.
Tell us, what is Get It Together Bristol?
It's a project that's being funded for 3 years by BT. We're based at the Futures Team, Bristol City Council. And the project is managed by Citizens Online, which is a national charity aimed at getting everyone online.
So the Futures Team, who are they? I didn't even know they existed at the council. They're looking ahead, I guess, aren't they, into the future?
Yeah, it's about making the city ready to meet the future, and part of that is opening up internet access across the city.
Now, it seems this is the whole issue of digital inclusion. A lot of youngsters are very good at it, and a lot of, middle-aged people like me and older people, they get the youngsters to do it for them.
Yeah. Well, statistics out in May of this year showed that 99% of 16 to 24-year-olds are online, but only 4 in 10 of people over the age of 75 are.
Okay, but I mean, a lot of people of that age, they just think, well, I just don't want anything to do with this blasted internet. There's nothing really in it for me, and actually, I don't really like it. I mean, they're kind of 21st century Luddites, aren't they?
Yeah. Some more statistics for you. 56% of people over 65 voluntarily exclude themselves from having internet access, compared to the national average of 22%. They just maybe don't see the benefits of getting online, or they're put off by the jargon, or they just really feel that they've been left behind.
Well, I think for a lot of people, the online experience is not one that they really want to have to grapple with at that age. You know, that isn't that, you know, do you come across that quite a lot?
I think if people are in work, they kind of get used to it. But if you've retired and you think that computers are to do with the office, then no, people really don't see the point of it. A lot of our the people that I speak to that come on our courses that we run across the city say, oh, I'm too old, or quite often they say it's their children or their grandchildren have just nagged them until they feel that they have to just join in. They are quite reluctant.
Okay, so these courses, you're running, I think, 11 courses. Whereabouts do they take place? And what are they, different courses, or the same courses in different parts of the city?
Okay, what we do is we run 11 courses across the city. So most of them are based in libraries. So Knowle, Stockwood, Henbury, Central, Bedminster, Henley's, all over the place. And then we've got a few courses that we run in connection with Linkage. So in Whitehall, in Shirehampton. And they're 5-week courses, 2 hours a week. And they're very, very friendly. We have a team of volunteer tutors. And what we aim to do is to make people very relaxed in a learning environment. Small groups as well. Most groups are about 5 learners and up to 10 at Junction 3 Library. So small, friendly and safe.
So is it the same basic course but run in different places?
Yes. On week one, we have a chat about jargon and make people feel comfortable in the group, and people learn how to use a mouse. Week two, we look at how to use a keyboard very simply. Week three, we take the plunge and we go onto the internet. And then week four, we look at emailing and we set people up with email accounts. And then week five, we can recap, we can practice, and we can also look at things like tablets, buying equipment and Skyping.
Okay, now the big question, of course, is going to be access cost. Are these courses free? If so, to who?
Okay, they are free. We in Bristol, Get It Together projects are based all over the UK. But in Bristol, we're particularly keen to hear from people over 55, people with disabilities and carers. They call one number, and that's mine. I talk them through the content of the course, make sure that it's appropriate, and they get signed up.
Okay. You also do, which I think is brilliant, outreach courses. So you're able to actually go to maybe church groups and other groups around the city, small community groups, to do courses for them. That's brilliant. And what do? You take computers with you?
Yes, we've got 5 laptops and I can take out Wi-Fi with me, which means that you don't even need to have an internet access in your venue. So what I'd like to do is hear from people that have access to a group of learners for them to call me up and I'll take it from there. And that is free as well.
I wonder, do you ever have older people that are doing these courses that even after whatever it is, 5 weeks, they say, no, I've had enough. I don't like the internet now. I never will.
Let me tell you, our oldest learner was 98 and he's still going strong. Citizens Online do what they call a longitudinal study. So what we do is we contact people after 3 months, 6 months and 12 months after they finish the course. And after 12 months, 80% of our learners are still using the internet regularly. So it does work.
Now, one of the problems, of course, is that there's more and more things actually you have to go online to do.
Yes.
It does seem as if for some people, and maybe this is why older people are a bit reluctant, that it's almost like we're not really being given a choice. We have to go online if you want to do some of the basic things in life.
There's a lot of organisations that seem to forget that there's a whole group of people that have never been on the internet. And it is quite a shame, because the more people get left behind, the more that they feel that there's too much of a gap to catch up with. The idea of our courses is that we promote the benefits, and we would talk about access to health benefits. Some of the people that we have on our courses are late 50s, early 60s, and they're job seekers, and they go to the job centre and they're told to get online to find a job, and they haven't got a clue where to start. And there's a great range of job clubs across the city of Bristol, but they expect you to have a basic level of being able to, you know, to get online and to use the computer, and that's where we step in.
Okay, Julie, whereabouts, Julianne,
yes.
Whereabouts can people get hold of you? Not necessarily online, maybe using an old-fashioned telephone.
I mean, if people can get online, please do go and look at our website, because that explains where we are. So just type in Bristol Get It Together. Citizens Online have got a great website as well. And we're on Facebook. But if you'd just like to speak to me to talk through, you know, what the courses are about and whether they're suitable for you, please call me. Can I give you my number? Okay, it's 077-854-62568. And if you get my voicemail, please leave a message and I promise to get back to you.
Okay, better give us that number once more.
Okay. 077-854-62568.
Okay, Julianne Burrows, thanks very much. And we'll give that number, in case you didn't manage to get it down, a final one more time at the end of the show. Thanks, Julianne.
Thank you, Tony.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
We're beginning to sound like the tech show this week, because we've talked mostly about computers. Mind you, that's not necessarily a bad thing. We do need to know how these things affect our lives. What with the digital revolution, if it really is a revolution, we shall see. Anyway, I'm joined now by Elia Pablo and our tech roundup, our weekly tech roundup. But Elia, this week we've had a pretty shocking story, haven't we? 2 weeks, apparently, to enforce our computers against a massive virus attack. Now, this really means somehow, possibly, some virus called Game Over Zeus may be coming into our computer to take it over.
Hello, Tony. Yes, it's been blocked by the FBI together with all sorts of international communities. And what they are doing now is they are taking control about it. This virus, what it has done is a malware that gets into your computer through email normally. So basically, the users download an attached file from the email, let's say from a bank. So it seems quite legitimate, and they download it, and what they are doing is actually getting into the virus.
Okay, so this is a really important thing for people to know about. Attachments are often a way that by clicking on an attachment, that can stick some sort of Trojan horse or malware onto your computer. So be very careful about only clicking on attachments that you trust. Okay, so that's how Game Over's use starts. What is it as a wider bit of software? What does it then start doing once it's on your computer?
What it does is that it looks for information about your finances. So it gets, let's say, your credit card details, your keys, everything, and it can actually steal money. It's been already cases about this. In the case that they cannot find any useful information, they download another virus called CryptoLocker, What this does is it locks your computer, and then you cannot open any file, any photograph, you cannot get into internet, you cannot go online or email, nothing at all. And it comes a message saying you're like to unlock your computer, you have to pay a fee. The thing is, it's actually not secure. Like, you cannot have guaranteed that your computer is going to be unlocked even if you pay the fee.
Well, no, and apparently because now this has been discovered, it's less likely that someone is going to come back to you and unlock your computer for you. But this is all sorts of ramifications of this. I mean, we don't want to frighten people, but actually, in a way, you're quite conscious of internet security in the past, then hopefully you won't have been clicking on attachments that you don't know. So who has been controlling this? Do we know?
Well, there was the FBI and the NCA have been accusing a Russian guy against it, but it's been a massive plot with, like, other criminals. So what it's afraid is that they are going to go back. Right now, the FBI is in control of the botnet. The botnet is the network of hijacked home computers that have been controlling by this criminal gang.
Hijacked computers, crikey. Look, another thing I ought to really say straight away is back up everything. This is really a reminder that when you have anything that's valuable on your phone or your computer, always you can get yourself a little backup program.
Yes.
Or buy one of these backup drives where you can just make sure all of the sensitive and useful information you've got is backed up onto one of those drives. Do you do that?
Yes, I always do it. Like, I have my external pen drive and I have all my things in there, and I need to update it every month or like add new files, because you never know when you will need it. And actually, it's one of the advices that the NCA is giving to people, because the NCA is the ones that said we have now 2 weeks for this and to get save the computers, because they are saying, okay, right now we are in control of this, we know which computers have been hijacked, and then they are actually getting in contact with these users and giving them tools to sort it out.
Now, I know for a lot of people, they've got a lot of pictures. They might have videos, like maybe a wedding video, holiday video. These are massive files. They can't necessarily fit onto a little pen drive. But just to let people know, you can go out and buy massive drives, which
yes.
are like 1 terabyte, what's that, a 1,000 gigabyte drive, which will fit everything onto it if you really want to. And it's just a sensible idea. Businesses are always doing it, because obviously if they lose their data, and often they're advised to. So, yeah, good idea. Go and get a backup of some sort and try and back it up regularly. That just means that when someone comes along and does this, it will affect you. Less. Anyway, the FBI and other authorities can find these hijacked computers. So what are they doing next?
So, yeah, basically, as I just said, they get in contact with these people. They are sending them letters or emails telling them your computer has a virus called Zeus Game Over. Well, Game Over Zeus, actually. And the danger, actually, I have to mention, is that some hackers are actually using that by sending themselves these emails. So people are downloading the tools to get rid of the virus, and when they are actually doing is downloading more virus.
Oh my goodness. How do you know whether an email that you've got is actually really from the National Crime Agency?
What I would do, I would just go online. They have given this website that is www.getsafeonline.org, and just download the tools from there.
Okay, getsafeonline.org. And I think what we better do is give that web address at the end of the program again. So if you haven't, you want to find it and you didn't get that down, go and get yourself a pen and paper. We'll give you that number at the end of the show. Okay, so why does the FBI consider it a victory and the National Crime Agency, they're predicting 2 weeks for a new attack? It doesn't sound like much of a victory to me.
The thing is, the FBI is seeing it like, oh, we actually know who is behind this and we are in control of this hijacked computer, so we can actually fix it. While the NCA is saying, yes, but the criminals are actually going to be in control again. And they gave this time, which is just a guess, to be honest, of 2 weeks. So once they are in control again, they will start sending this virus all over again.
Now, if we link this with the discussion we had right at the beginning of the programme about the smart ID, this looks to me as if this is the sort of thing which might actually push more and more people to realise that some sort of digital ID online is going to be necessary for them in order to, for example, access their bank account. So, well, just be aware that this is an impetus for people to get more interested in having this wonderful smart ID, but then there's all sorts of pitfalls with that as well. But anyway, we in the last months we've had lots of problems with internet security, the Heartbleed, eBay telling everyone to get new passwords, and now this game over's use. What's going on?
That's my question. What's going on? Because my wonder is, if this is always happening, it's always like a current problem, but just we don't know, and now for any reason, like, people are interested that the public know, or it's actually something that is happening now. And linking it what you were saying with the electronic IDs, why do we need to do everything online? Every week, every day, we are learning internet is not secure. Why do we need to vote online? Why do we need to have electronic IDs? Let's say this virus can actually duplicate your electronic ID. What would this happen then?
Yes, and also maybe someone will sell it, especially if it's a private industry. This is one of the biggest problems, is a lot of this information is worth money to somebody. They might sell it to somebody.
Exactly.
Now, the funny thing is, right, in the old days, hundreds of years ago, we had Luddites. Now, the Luddites were a group of, which is always used to describe people who say, oh, well, I don't really like computers. Ah, you're a Luddite. But the people back in those times, a long time ago, what they were doing was they were objecting to the use of bringing in of new technology into the countryside in England, because what was happening is it was putting people out of work. And these new machines would come in to do with weaving, mostly in factories, and it meant that the people who had been making a living weaving in their lofts, that kind of thing, at home, no longer could sell their stuff, and it made them destitute. It meant they couldn't afford to buy food for their family. So when you hear the word Luddite applied, it might actually be quite a good thing. So you're trying to protect yourself, yeah, and you're trying to protect your family, not necessarily go along with the new technology. Anyway, that's my two halfpence on that subject. Now, you also have, because you're Spanish, aren't you?
Yes,
we have a big bit of news this week from Spain. Tell us a bit about your king, who's just announced he wants to abdicate. I won't even attempt to pronounce his name properly. You better do that.
His name is Juan Carlos I, so Juan Carlos I. And yeah, he surprised this week by announcing his abdication, which honestly was quite surprising because no one really expected. It's true that he's been having some health problems in the last years, but no one seemed to really make us think that he was gonna abdicate. And the way he did it, like, it wasn't him who announced his abdication, it was the Prime Minister Rajoy. Is everything very suspicious, and it's very weird, and everyone thinks there is something behind this abdication.
Okay, well, we'll see. We don't know, do we, yet? But tell us about his wife, Queen Sofia, because she doesn't live with him. Are they separated?
Yeah, well, they are technically not separated, but it's very well known in Spain they are not together. They are not a couple anymore, if they have ever been a couple. The king, or the former king, well, he's still actually the king. He has lots of lovers. He has some bastards all around Europe, and actually he's been, like, the press discovered it or make it public in the last years. He has a current lover for maybe the last 10 years.
Okay, and Queen Sofia, I saw her taking photographs at one of these Bilderberg conferences a few years ago. She came past in the car, she looked around, her head moved like this. She really looked at the public as if they were some kind of scum. She was quite really looking at us in a really nasty way, like, you know, go away, you horrible people. But anyway, she, I think, lives in London, doesn't she?
Yeah, she, well, that, it's not proven, but yeah, the press says that she lives in London. She definitely doesn't live where the king does.
Okay, and also, go back a little bit to the days of Franco. Juan Carlos was the king then. Was he friendly with Franco in the fascist days?
Well, he wasn't the king during the dictatorship.
Okay.
So basically, Franco chose Juan Carlos to be his successor because he was a right man and he wanted to install the monarchy again. Like, we have to remind that the civil war started after the proclaim of the Republic, of the Second Republic of Spain. And yeah, at the beginning it seemed Juan Carlos and Franco got on well, but then Franco died, and then Juan Carlos became the king and asked for the democracy and called for elections, and everything was going smoothless. But then the military did a try to coup d'etat, which was called off by Juan Carlos. That's why he was so popular in Spain, because they saw him as the savior of the democracy, while before they just see him as the puppet of Franco.
Okay, but you see, this, the thing that bothers me is we haven't heard anything in the coverage of the Juan Carlos abdication that it was actually Franco that chose Juan Carlos
yes.
to be the king. So anyway, also, he shot one of his brothers, didn't he? So was that when he was a prince, Juan Carlos?
Yeah, it was before. It was while Franco was in power, and it was just an accident. I don't know the details, but it was involved guns. He shot accidentally his brother. They were actually playing, and his gun was actually charged. And Franco covered it, so like make it seem as an accident.
Oh, really?
And then Juan Carlos is kind of owed him a favor. That's why they got so close, apparently. And yeah, but like years after, journalist very close to the royal family asked him in public, I know that. I know you killed your brother. Is that true? And he said, yes. He said it in public.
Right. And it was his younger brother that he killed, who
yes.
might have been a rival to him for the throne, possibly at some point.
I don't think so.
No?
I think it was just an accident.
Just an
yes.
accident. Well,
yes.
let's hope so. Not a very sensible thing to do, whether a gun is loaded or not, to point it at your
Definitely.
Brother's forehead and pull the trigger. I think that's a pretty basic bit of instruction for everybody. Don't play around with guns. Maybe King Juan Carlos should have been told that by his mum.
Yeah.
Okay, now, republicanism in Spain, is it still strong? Because obviously, Franco brought in the monarchy as it is today, and back before the Second World War, the Spanish were fighting very much against the monarchy.
Basically, yes, it is still very updated, and now is more stronger as ever, I would say, because just after the abdication of Juan Carlos, there has been all these movements asking for a referendum for the republic or the monarchy. So actually to decide if there is going to be a new king or if there is not going to be any king at all. And last Monday, it has been all sorts of demonstrations in Spain, in the main cities of Spain, with lots of people actually going there asking for this referendum.
Okay, at last. So your referendum in Catalonia. What is that happening soon, or is that,
well,
what's happening with that?
In theory, it's in the 9th of November. I actually like you to ask me this, because some of these people who are actually now asking for this referendum for the Republic, they are actually against the referendum in Catalonia because it's against the Constitution. But the referendum they are asking is also against the Constitution, so it's kind of weird, don't you think?
Yeah, it is very strange. For some reason, once there's a lot of power in a few people's hands, they don't really seem to like people having referenda, do they? For some reason, I don't know why that is. They like to get more power, but they don't like to ever give it away. And also, of course,
exactly.
with this business with the abdication of King Juan Carlos, it sends a subtle message, doesn't it, to the Queen here in England? Don't you think it's time to abdicate? This is, of course, what she doesn't want to do, because I don't think she's all that happy about the idea of leaving Britain in the hands of Prince Charles.
Can I say something? A few years ago, there was like all these rumors that Felipe was asking his father to abdicate it, because he's been involved a lot of scandals with this lover that has been discovered now, with hunting elephants in an illegal place. And now we don't know if he's related with all the corruption cases with his daughter and his son-in-law, but he's there. He's in the emails that he's been publishing. So Felipe asked him to abdicate it, to just clean the image of the monarchy, and he said no. And a few years after, he's actually abdicating. Why?
Good question. Also, his wife, Felipe's wife, I suppose she's a princess, Letizia. Tell us a little bit about her.
Well, it's a funny story. Letizia was a very well-known journalist. She was the presenter of the public TV in Spain.
Oh, right. So she'd be like a BBC news presenter over here.
Exactly.
You know, something
yes.
like that.
Imagine.
So he saw her on the TV and fell in love. Is it that simple?
It was kind of this, yes. And then like he actually arranged a meeting with some friends, and he knew he had a friend in common with her, a journalist, and he asked him to to invite her and introduce each other. So she didn't know that the Prince of Spain was after her. Then she wasn't into the monarchy thing at all. She didn't want to get involved. And the beginning of the relationship was quite difficult because she didn't
want
to.
She was a Republican?
No, not her, but actually her grandfather is a Republican. So it's quite funny. But then finally, the love triumph, I would say.
Yes, or maybe money, who knows. Yeah. Anyway, let's see how it goes. Wish them all the very best of luck, and thanks very much, Elia Pablo.
Thank you.
Our tech chat, and also keeping us up to date with what's going on with the Spanish monarchy.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
And I'm joined by Jason Yannakopoulos now. Hi, Jason.
Hello, Tony.
And welcome to, I shouldn't really say welcome to Dialect. You're here every week. But anyhow, we're looking at the news from the week. Tax avoidance again. I mean, it must be the 20th time we've had tax avoidance.
Well, it never goes
agenda.
Away.
Okay, so what's the latest on the tax avoidance scene?
Well, it's Vodafone again.
Not them. Oh, yes.
The value of Britain as a tax haven for the world's biggest multinationals is revealed in Vodafone's latest surreal results. The company has been known for generous worldwide tax payments. I've never been known for generous worldwide tax payments, typically reporting a tax rate well below the average of countries it operates in. But for the year to this March, its figures show a credit that is a profit of £14.8 billion from tax.
So how do you mean?
Well, it's not the accounting result of the firm recognising future tax benefits worth £17.4 billion of losses racked up in Luxembourg. This equates to around £70 billion of losses booked in the Grand Duchy of Luxembourg.
Oh, now I understand, right? I understand everything. Because the former guy from Luxembourg, it looks like he's going to become the president of the European Union. And this is so that we can have the expert in tax avoidance running the EU, appointed by nobody apart from a bunch of people. I think it's the Council of Europe that chooses him. Anyway, so what Vodafone are up to is they've got several different operations in different countries. Some of them make massive, massive losses and others make profits. And so if it looks like they're about to pay tax in one place, they say, oh, I'm sorry, we're offsetting the losses from another place.
They offset it to Luxembourg because, of course, they have to pay tax of anywhere they provide a service. But here's a really interesting thing. They don't provide any services in Luxembourg.
Ironic. Okay. Vodafone, slap, slap, slap again in the tax avoidance world. Okay, also GlaxoSmithKline, I think, are in private eye as well this week, Jason.
This is a very interesting one. China have decided to charge Mark Reilly, GlaxoSmithKline's former boss in China, with bribery of doctors and officials. And it's a major failure for Britain's biggest drugs company. But who was overseeing the ethical management of this time? Step forward, James Murdoch.
Oh,
son
dear.
Of Rupert Murdoch.
Oh dear, the man who was alleged was involved in similar sorts of practices here in Britain. Now we wonder what happened to him. So he's gone over working for these massive pharmaceutical companies.
Joined their board in February 2009 as a £100,000 a year non-executive director of
right.
GlaxoSmithKline.
So he doesn't have to do too much work, but he does get lots and lots of money. Now, that almost sounds like GlaxoSmithKline are bribing their directors by paying them so much.
Well, it's interesting. It says when he took over the role of ethical management, he will also be in addition to the board's corporate responsibility committee, an area where he's shown particular leadership in B-Sky News Corporation.
Oh, dear. Okay, so, yes, I think he actually had to leave in and under a cloud, as I seem to remember, that he didn't show all that wonderful leadership. So how ironic. So he's just as we thought we'd got rid of James Murdoch, he's back and he's working for the drug companies.
Which is kind of worrying a bit.
Okay, whistleblowing at the Department for Work and Pensions. This is Ian Duncan Smith's little baby.
Urgent questions are being asked at the Department for Work and Pensions over a failure to investigate properly allegations of fraud by CTEC, which has various contracts with the Department for Work and Pensions to try and help jobless people find work. Officials assured two whistleblowers last...
I'm going to stop you there, because that doesn't seem to be what CTEC does. My experience when I was unemployed here in Bristol, if they're not trying to help you get work, they're just trying to get you off the dole so they can get their £15,000 or whatever it happens to be for getting one long-term unemployed person off benefits, and they don't care what kind of bullying techniques they use to do it, whether it's being condescending to you, shouting at you and telling you why haven't you got a job, that kind of thing. So anyway, what did they say about CTEC in private eye?
Two whistleblowers last autumn said the department would be officially investigating claims that CTEC had been artificially inflating the number of jobs it was finding for disabled clients through the work choice scheme and pocketing the profits.
Oh, so that's fraud.
Effectively, yes.
Well, it's interesting because CTEC, the contracts for CTEC, I looked into this, and they're actually run by an organisation called Rehab Job Fit, which is based in Swansea. Even though it's the southwest and Bristol, they've got these contracts. Rehab Job Fit, there's been a massive scandal in Ireland with Rehab Job Fit being found doing all sorts of crooked stuff. And yet we haven't heard about that on the news here in Britain, only in the news in Ireland. How interesting. The same organisation that's doing the work programme, which apparently, according to some surveys, show they actually get less people into work than if they were to just allow the job centres to do it on their own.
Huh.
Okay, another story. Crooked accountants and lawyers.
Well, we might be in for a bit of good news here for a change.
Oh, good. What, crooked accountants? How can that be good news, Jason?
They're about to be targeted.
Oh, okay, good.
So, crooked accountants, lawyers and other professionals who profit from crime, who were beyond the reach of the law, will now be targeted according to measures that were announced in the Queen's speech on Wednesday.
Okay, and also seriously ill patients who are not getting medication. Now, you know, this seems to be a catalogue of disaster from Private Eye, almost. Or this is actually from the Eye newspaper, isn't it? Seriously ill patients not getting their medication. Why is that?
Thousands of patients, some seriously ill, are facing disgraceful and unsafe delays in receiving prescription medication because of failures at a company contracted to deliver them by the NHS.
Oh, don't tell me. It's part of this wonderful privatisation of the NHS.
Yep, seeming so. An investigation by the Bureau of Investigative Journalism for the Eye has found some patients suffering from illnesses such as cancer, haemophilia and HIV have endured significant delays in receiving their drugs because problems at the private contractor Healthcare at Home. The company's helpline has been swamped with anxious patients and relatives, with many unable to get through because of the sheer volume of the calls.
I don't know about the idea of a profit motive being used in caring for people when if you care for them less, you make more money. Doesn't sound like a very good idea to me. Anyway, finally, the Mars TV show. Now, this sounds great. This is a picture in the Eye this week showing something that looks like 1970s TV program, like Space 1999, Moonbase Alpha, but it's not, it's on Mars. What's happening, Jason?
And finally, section. Aspiring astronauts competing for a one-way ticket to Mars must demonstrate supreme physical and psychological skills.
Hang on, a one-way ticket?
Yes. Now, Endemol, the creators of Big Brother, is to turn the world's toughest job interview, the section of the first humans to establish a permanent settlement on Mars, it's the ultimate reality TV show.
So, but people can't come back. It's only one way.
This sounds very good. One way.
This sounds like if people start freaking out that they're fed up with Mars and they need to come home, what do they do then?
The privately funded Mars One mission aims to land 20 humans on Mars by 2025. More than 200,000 people worldwide apply to join the first human colony on the Red Planet, where they will set up home on an inflatable pod. Stick to Mars, where temperatures can be minus 60 degrees centigrade. There's very little oxygen. However, Mars One, led by Dutch businessman Bas Lansdorp, will send additional crews every 2 years, so I suppose that's how you can get back if you don't like it, to further build the pioneering colony.
Oh, but maybe they're only one way, those crews that are arriving.
Well, I don't know. The cost of the first mission is expected to be around £3.6 billion, and funds will be raised by selling exclusive broadcasting rights to the mission built around global Big Brother style event.
I would warn anybody against putting any money into this because I don't think you're ever going to see it because people just simply won't do
it.
I mean, that's my feeling. It sounds to me like someone's having a laugh with us down at Endemol.
Well, I did say it was our and finally section for that reason.
Are you one of the people who's booked up to go, Jason?
No.
Okay. Jason Yannakopoulos, thanks very much, and we'll see you
thanks
next week.
Tony.
Cheers. That's all for this week. You can hear this program at dialectradio1word.co.uk. www.bcfm.co.uk as well as on BCFM. Thanks to our guests this week, especially Julianne Burrows. Her phone number's 07785 462 568. That's 07785 462 568 for those computer courses. Activistpost.com, you'll find a lot, including interviews with Julie Beale and her articles too. And her own website is getmindsmart.com. Elia's for downloading the software to clean your computers and get advice is getsafeonline.org. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.
every year we get a gospel dance record as good as Sounds of Blackness's Optimistic or this one, Lisa Taylor's.